of Love, lecture number 2, 22nd of December 1976 at the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh Ashram, Pune.
The first question. The question is from Veereshwar. Many people in the West are engaged in the creation of a science or technology of enlightenment. The need is certainly there, but how do you see the possibility? Is it irresponsible to engage in its creation without having reached the state of enlightenment? Is the Arika method a valid approach? The first and most fundamental thing to be remembered is that enlightenment can never have a technology. By its very nature, it is impossible. But the West is obsessed with technology. So whatsoever comes into the hands of the West, it starts reducing it into a technology. Technology is an obsession. For the outside world, science is a valid approach, but partial, not total. Not the only approach, but only one of the approaches. Poetry is as much valid as science. Science is knowledge without love. And that is the danger in it. Because it is knowledge without love, it is always in the service of death and never in the service of life. Hence, the whole progress of science is leading man towards a global suicide. One day, when the man has committed the suicide, the Third World War, cockroaches will think that we are the most fit to survive. Some Darwin, cockroach Darwin, will prove that we are the fittest because we have survived. Survival of the fittest. Man has committed suicide. He has destroyed himself. Knowledge without love is dangerous because in its very root is poison. Love keeps balance, never allows knowledge to go too far. So it never becomes destructive. Science is knowledge without love. That is its danger. But it is one of the valid approaches. The object, the material, can be known without love. There is no need. But life is not only the matter. Life is suffused with something tremendously transcendental. That transcendental is missed. And then, science by and by automatically turns into a technology. It becomes mechanical. More and more it becomes a means to exploit the nature, to manipulate the nature. The very beginning of science has been with that idea, how to conquer nature. That's a foolish idea. We are not separate from nature. How can we conquer it? We are nature. So who is going to conquer whom? It is absurd. With that absurdity, science has destroyed much. The whole nature is destroyed. The climate is poisoned. The air, the water, the seas, everything polluted. The whole harmony is dying. The ecology is being continuously destroyed. Please remember, this is enough, more than enough. Don't turn science inwards. If the application of scientific methodology has been so devastating for the outer nature, it is going to be more devastating to the inner nature, because you are moving towards the more subtle. Even for the outside nature, a different kind of knowledge is needed, which is rooted in love. But for the innermost core of your being, the subtlest, the transcendental, knowledge is not needed at all. Innocence is needed. Innocence with love. Then you will know inside. Then you will know the interior of your being, the subjectivity. But West is obsessed with technology. It seems technology has succeeded in nature. We have become more powerful. We have not become more powerful. The whole idea is just fallacious. We have not become more powerful. We are becoming every day weaker, because the natural resources are being exhausted. Sooner or later, the earth will be empty. It will not grow anything. We are not becoming powerful. We are becoming every day weaker and weaker and weaker. We are on the deathbed. Humanity cannot survive the way it has been behaving with nature more than 50 years, 60 years, or at the most 100 years, which is nothing. If the Third World War does not happen, then we will be committing a slow suicide. Within 100 years, we will be gone. Not even a trace will be left. And man will not be the first who will disappear. Many other animals, very strong animals, have disappeared from the earth. They used to roam the earth. They were the kings of the earth, bigger than the elephant. They are no more anywhere. They were thinking they have become very powerful. They were very huge, with tremendous energy, but then the earth could not supply food for them. They began to become bigger and bigger and bigger. Then a moment came when the earth could not supply food for them. They had to die. The same is happening with man. Man thinks he is becoming more and more powerful. He can reach to the moon, but he is destroying the earth. He is destroying the all possibility of future life. Slowly, humanity is disappearing. Please don't turn your technology towards the inner. Enough harm you have done. Enlightenment cannot be reduced to a technology. So the first thing, the inner journey is of innocence, not of knowledge. Certainly not of science. absolutely not of technology. It is more of love, innocence, silence. Meditation is not a technique really, because you cannot understand anything else than the technique. I have to talk in terms of technique, otherwise meditation is not a technique at all. Meditation is nothing that you do. Meditation is something that you fall in, just like love. Meditation is something in which you can be, but you cannot do it. Doing ceases. How can there be a technology for non-doing? Technology is relevant with doing. You have to do something. Meditation is not something that you do. It is only when your doer has gone and you are totally relaxed, not doing anything, in a deep let go, rest. There is meditation. Then meditation flowers. It is the flowering of your being. It has nothing to do with becoming. It is not an achievement. It is not an improvement. It is just being that which you already are. What technique is needed? People are foolish, that's why techniques have to be talked about. If you understand, nothing is needed. Just being silent and just being yourself. Not moving in any direction, not moving at all. And you will see the benediction, the meditation. When this meditation has become a spontaneous flow, that you need not even sit for it in a certain posture, that you need not find a small corner in the house where nobody disturbs you, when in the marketplace also it is there, talking, walking, doing, eating, it is there. When it is always there, even when you are asleep, it is there. You go on feeling it. It goes on like breathing or the beating of the heart. That's what Kabir calls Sahaj Samadhi, spontaneous ecstasy. It needs no technique. It needs only spontaneity. It needs only naturalness. It needs only simplicity. So I say to you, blessed are the ignorant, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Become innocent and become ignorant. Don't remain knowledgeable. But in the West it is happening. Now, they are trying to manipulate the minds. They are trying to create mechanisms to manipulate the mind. This is going to be far more dangerous than the science. This is going to be far more dangerous, because once you know how to manipulate the mind of man, you will reduce man also into an automata. That's what's going to happen. Once you know that the man and his mind can be manipulated, totally manipulated, then all freedom will be gone. All individuality will be gone. Then electrodes can be put into your head without your knowing ever. And you can be manipulated from Delhi, from Moscow, from Washington, from the capital. Just by radio waves you can be manipulated. The whole country can be ordered. And nobody will see the order coming from anywhere. It will come from within you. An electrode is there. Just on radio waves, you can be ordered. And you will follow it automatically. All freedom will be gone. You can be hypnotized any moment. You can be put into any hallucination and you will believe in it. It will be so real and it will be coming from within you. Then from Delhi, from Moscow, from Washington, from London, from the capital places. There is no need to keep police and no need to keep the magistrate. This is too costly and uneconomical. These are like bullock carts. No need. Better technology will be available. No need to keep all these people to enforce. No need even for the priest to go on teaching morality and religion. Just from the capital place, the orders can be given that you are all happy and you will all feel happy. That you are all contented and you all will feel contented. You may be dying, starving, but you will feel contented. You may be on your deathbed, suffering, but if the order comes that you are happy and there is no death, you will believe you are happy and there is no death. And this will be coming from within you. That's what Delgado proposes to do someday. And he says then man will be happy. Nobody will be unhappy. But this happiness will not be true happiness. Then there are mechanisms by which alpha waves can be created in your mind. Just by electrical stimulation. That is dangerous. Because that will not allow you to know the reality. And those alpha waves will be created from the outside. They will not be true. They will not be real. And God will disappear. Then there is no need for God. You are not unhappy. So why seek happiness? And you will believe in the dogma. Whatsoever dogma happens to be there, followed by your politicians and your priests, you will believe in the dogma. You will absolutely believe in the dogma and there will be no doubt. Skepticism will disappear. This is a dangerous step. Meditation should not be reduced into technology and enlightenment cannot be reduced. Enlightenment means awareness. Witnessing. Enlightenment is neither of the body nor of the mind. It is of the beyond. The body can be manipulated by a mechanism. The mind can be manipulated by a mechanism. But your soul is beyond and cannot be manipulated by any mechanism whatsoever. You ask many people in the West are engaged in the creation of a science of technology of enlightenment. Those people are criminals. They are dangerous people. Avoid them. Just these same people were engaged in creating technology 200 years before. They have destroyed nature. Now they are turning towards consciousness. They will destroy that too. Now there is a movement all over the world to protect the ecology of nature, the naturality of nature. But it is too late really. Now nothing can be done, nothing much can be done. And there's these people who propagate in favor of ecology appear like eco-nuts. Another species of Jehovah's Witnesses. Fanatics. Desperately fighting something which seems impossible. Before the plague of technology turns into human consciousness, stop it. Stop it in the seed. And you say, the need is certainly there. It is not. Certainly not. There is no need. But how do you see the possibility? There is no possibility either. But man is dangerous. The more impossible a thing, the more he becomes attracted and challenged. That's what Edmund Hillary said when he reached to the top of the Everest. Somebody asked him, "Why you tried it at all? What is the point? Why?" Edmund Hillary said, "I had to, because the Everest is there. Because it is there, I had to. It stands like a challenge. Anything unconquerable is a challenge to man's ego. There is no possibility. Naturally, it will never happen. But that very impossibility can become a challenge to these mad, obsessed people who want to reduce everything into technique. They cannot create a technology of enlightenment. That is not possible at all in the very reality. But they can create a technology which can manipulate the mind and even deceive people and create an illusion of enlightenment. That's what is happening with the drugs. The drugs have become a technology of enlightenment. And the guru of the drugs, Ginsberg, he goes on talking as if all the mystics of the world were talking the same things, were trying to give you the same vision as LSD can give, or psilocybin, or marijuana. It is nonsense. No drug can lead you to enlightenment, but drugs can create an illusion of enlightenment. Is it irresponsible to engage in its creation without having reached the state of enlightenment? Only people who have not known enlightenment can try it. Those who have known cannot even think of the possibility. And it is irresponsible. Is the Arika method a valid approach? Arika method is technology, techniques, knowledge without love. And hence the danger is there. It will turn people into robots. Remember always, freedom is the goal, moksha. Absolute freedom is the goal. You can turn human beings into robots, they will be less miserable. In fact, if you become a perfect robot, how you can be miserable? A machine is never miserable. Of course, never happy too, but never miserable. Erika methods are any methods which exist without love are dangerous. And this again is very difficult to make a distinction. Because the same method can be used with love, and then it is meaningful. And the same method can be used without love, and it becomes dangerous. And it is very difficult from the outside to see whether the method is being used with love or without love. The Arika methods have been chosen from different schools, Sufi, Gurdjieff, Tibetan, Indian, Japanese. It is eclectic. From all over the world, they have chosen techniques. In the first place, they are chosen from different schools. There is not a harmony in them. There is no center in them. It is just like a piled up thing, a crowd of people, a mob, not a family. Because the techniques come from different schools. A Sufi technique is bound to be different from a Zen technique. Both function, both work, but they work in their own system. They cannot work outside the system. It is as if you take one part of one car and try to fix that part into another car of another make, and it doesn't work, and you are puzzled why it doesn't work. It used to work in the first car. There was a harmony. It was meant for that car. A Zen method works in a Zen philosophy. A Sufi method works in a Sufi philosophy. A Tibetan method works with Tibetan occult esoteric Buddhism. A yoga method works with Patanjali system. You cannot just choose those methods from anywhere. Otherwise, you can make a car few parts from the Rolls-Royce, few from Lincoln, few from Cadillac, and few from Fiat, and you can jumbling parts from everywhere. Your car is dangerous. It is not going anywhere in the first place. And you are fortunate if it doesn't move. It moves, then you are more unfortunate. Erica has chosen from different schools. Erica is very greedy, eclectic. But there exists no center. It is not an orchestra. It is a market noise. First thing, if you follow too much the Erica method, you will not arrive to your center. You will come to many experiences on the periphery, but you will never arrive to your center. And all your experiences will be not of a family, fragmentary. And it is dangerous. You can fall into pieces. The second thing, there is no love because there is no center, and love arises only from the center. This collection of so many methods is soulless. There is no soul in it. So you can become very, very efficient in the methods, and yet you will see that your heart is not flowering. You will become efficient, but you will not become blissful. You may become less miserable. You may be less tense. You may become more capable to control yourself. You may have a more stronger ego, but you will not have a soul. The methods are all valid, taken in their own context. But Erica has not yet any philosophy, no harmony. And this is not a way to create a harmony. The way is just the opposite. In fact, Buddhism is born when Buddha became enlightened. The center came first, and then he started creating few methods to help those people who are not yet enlightened, to help them come to the center that he has already achieved. The center came first, then the periphery. So it is with Jalaluddin Rumi. He became enlightened first, and when he became enlightened, he was dancing. He was whirling. Not to become enlightened, he had never known about it. Just whirling, he liked very much. And he felt very peaceful. It was a coincidence. While he was whirling, he became enlightened. When he became enlightened, he started thinking how to help people. The center came first, then he started the Sufi methods. The same is with Patanjali. With Arika, it is totally different. There is no enlightened being at the center. Of course, a very clever person who has collected many methods from many sources and many directions and many traditions. But there is no center. It is only a periphery. So people who go into Arika will sooner or later feel stuck. It will take you to a certain extent, and then suddenly you will see there is going to be no growth, and you will become dry like desert. Because unless love flows, flowers never come up. Trees don't grow. Rivers don't flow. The ultimate blooming is always that of love. The second question: one day you said that you were an egoist. On another day, that an egoist could not be happy. And you say you are happy. Can you comment, please? Never listen to what I say. Only look at me, listen to me. Don't be too much bothered by the words. Look direct. Can you see any ego in this person sitting here talking to you? Don't be too much concerned with what I say. In fact, only an absolutely egoless person can say that I am the biggest egoist of the world. Ordinarily, the ego tries to hide itself. You tell somebody that you are an egoist, he will feel offended. He may be, but he will feel offended. The more he is, the more he will feel offended. The ego wants to function from the unconscious. From the dark corner. It never comes into the light. I can say to you that I am the greatest egoist of the world because there is no problem. And I told you that my ego includes all. How can an ego include all? The ego has to exclude. Otherwise, definition is lost. The ego has to say that you are you and I am I. And I am higher than you. And greater than you. The ego has to depend on the definition, demarcation. When I say that I include you all, my ego is so vast that it includes all. It does not exclude anything, not even the devil. Then the you disappears. And when the you disappears, how the I can exist? But the question is from an Englishman. That's natural. Englishmen don't have a sense of humor. He took it seriously. They are serious people. He must have started thinking that this man is contradicting. I am a non-serious person. I am allowed to contradict. It is said that whenever a joke is told to an Englishman, he laughs 3 times. First, when he listens to the joke, and of course, he never understands it. He laughs just to be polite, so the other person does not feel offended that you have not understood, or his joke was missed. Not to make him embarrassed, he laughs loudly. Then he laughs 2nd time in the night, in the middle of the night, when he catches hold of the joke. Right, he says. Then he laughs. And then he laughs 3rd time at his own ridiculousness, laughing at them in the middle of the night. How foolish and how un-English. Curiosity and a strong thirst to have the eternal goal has brought me to your camp. Can curious, suspicious persons not become good followers? Your advice to me to leave your camp immediately seems rather harsh. First, curiosity and a strong thirst never exist together. Curiosity is never thirst. Curiosity is childish. One simply wants to know. It is like an itching. Nothing serious is involved. You are not ready to pay anything for it. You are simply curious. You are not serious about it. It is not a deep thirst in you. It is not that knowing it you are going to change your life, your style, your way, your being. Just by the way you want to know. You are not much concerned. Many people come to me. They ask one question. Somebody comes and says, what do you think? God exists or not? No, even to ask such a question needs a very stupid man. The question is so vast, so unutterable, that if you are really thirsty, you will not be able to verbalize it. You may cry. You may weep. But you will not be able to utter it. The question is so vast, so tremendous. How can you say it? Even to say it is to make it profane. It is a sacrilege. The question is so sacred, so holy, that you throb with it, but you cannot formulate it. I know those people also. They come and they start trembling and they say, we don't know what we have to ask. Sometimes a person comes to me and says, Bhagwan, what should I ask? Now, this is a man of a total different quality. He cannot even formulate his question. Because life is so vast and big, how to put it into a question? The moment you put it into a question, it looks childish. Questions and answers exist only in schools, not in life. Somebody comes and asks, does God exist? And he is expecting a question, yes or no. You have been trained in your schools, colleges, universities to answer. Everything and anything you have been trained to answer. You have never been trained to question. Remember, you have been trained to answer. Your examination papers simply give you a few questions. You have to answer. Answer is expected. Question is not important. The answer. Does God exist? And you wait there. And of course, there can be only two answers, yes or no. But will it be meaningful to say, yes, God exists? Will it solve anything at all? You must have heard that answer before. Or if it is answered that no, God does not exist, is it going to help you at all? You have heard before that answer too. Both answers are known. What you are asking, it is better to be silent. It is better to throb. It is better to cry and weep. It is better to open your heart. Your intensity, your thirst will not be curiosity. Curiosity never exists with a strong thirst. And you say curiosity and a strong thirst to have the eternal goal has brought me to your camp. I don't think. Curiosity may have brought you. And this person has been asking foolish questions. At least he must have asked 100 questions within 10 days. Intense thirst will make one question out of all questions. If your thirst is intense, then all questions are reduced to one question, and that question is, who am I? And all else is irrelevant. A thirsty person is not worried about God. He is not worried about whether there is a hell or heaven. He is not worried about past lives. He is not worried about the theory of karma and reincarnation. His whole problem is, I don't know who I am. This is the first and the last question. I have to know this. If I have known this, then everything else is secondary, can be known. But if I don't know myself, what is the point of knowing anything else? When there is passion for truth, then you have only one question, who am I? And in 100 questions the man has asked, there has not been a single question about who am I? He has not asked that question. The man is curious. And he says, to have the eternal goal. And the man is greedy too. You don't know yourself and you are hankering for the eternal goal. The greed, the ego. They desire the world. They desire the other world too. They desire money, bigger bank balance, bigger houses, bigger cars, and then they start desiring heaven and paradise and God. Everything has to be in their fist. Greedy people. You have to know who you are. And by knowing it, the eternal is revealed. Not by grabbing the eternal. You know yourself. No. You cannot grab the eternal. You are so tiny. Just think, a man, a very accidental man, thinking to grab the eternal. A small fever will kill you. 19, 8 degrees 0.6 and you are okay. And 4-5 degrees, it goes beyond 100 and you are gone. 4-5 degrees below 98 and you are gone. You cannot adjust beyond 110 degrees and you want to grab the eternal. You cannot exist without breath for a few minutes, 8 minutes, more than 8 minutes. You cannot exist. And you want to grab the eternal. A body that is already dying. From the very moment you were born, your body is dying. 70 years are nothing in this timeless procession, in this eternity. A man who is going to live 70 years wants to grab the eternity. Such a small head, where you will put the eternity in? It is as if somebody is trying to put the whole sea in a spoon. I have heard about a great philosopher, must have been Aristotle, I don't know exactly, but I suspect that he was taking a walk on the beach in the morning sun, and he saw a madman. The man looked mad, and he was carrying water in a teaspoon from the sea, and was pouring. He had dug a hole. And he will run again to the sea and will come again and again. And Aristotle saw him and he said, what he is doing? He came close and he said, what are you doing? The man said, I have decided to empty the whole ocean into this. Aristotle says, have you gone mad with this teaspoon? And in this small hole, and that vast ocean. And the madman started laughing. And he said, I was thinking that you are mad. I have heard that you want to understand the eternal truth. In this small head, who is mad? The man must have been a great seer. He shocked Aristotle very much, but he was true. Truth always shocks. Don't be greedy about truth. Because truth comes only when you are not greedy. And when you are not greedy, you are not small. Greed makes you small. When all greed disappears, your boundary disappears. Then you are not a small hole by the side of the ocean. Then the ocean is a small hole by the side of you. When the greed is not there. Truth is not something that you have to purchase. It is something that has to purchase you. You have to allow it. But the man is very knowledgeable. And knowledge never allows truth entry. All his 100 questions, he has been sowing his knowledge. All the scriptures that he knows, and all that he has heard, and all that has been conditioned into his head. Can curious, suspicious persons not become good followers? A curious person, a suspicious person, cannot even become a follower. Good follower is far away. Because to follow, you need to be in trust. To go with somebody into the unknown, at least you will have to have a little trust. And this man knows no trust. Suspicious is. no trust. Doubt cannot lead you into the inner journey. Doubt is good in science. Science depends on doubt. Doubt is a method in the world of science. If you trust, you will not move into science at all. You have to distrust. Science is an inimical method. Depends on antagonism. Religion, mysticism are totally different. Diametrically opposite. Trust is the method there, not doubt. If you trust me, you can come with me. There is no other way. And the questioner says, your advice to me to leave your camp immediately seems rather harsh. Harsh? You say harsh? Then you don't know anything about masters. It is not harsh. It is very polite. Have you heard about Zen masters? If you have asked the same question to a Zen master, he would have jumped on you. He would have pounded you then and there. He would have thrown you out of the ashram. Someday I will do it. Wait. Otherwise, why I have Sant and Kamal and Gurdayal? They will do the pounding. You wait a little more. You trust me a little more. And you will see. Harsh, you say? It is not harsh. It is simple compassion for you. You need it. You deserve it. Because a knowledgeable person needs shocks, electroshocks. I'm not here to make you more knowledgeable. I'm here to help you drop all your knowledge. The work is almost like one is fast asleep and you have to wake him. Of course, it is harsh. Have not you seen it yourself when the alarm goes early in the morning and you are getting ready for the dynamic meditation? And you want to say, hell with it. And you want to throw the clock. It is harsh. A master is an alarm. A master has to be very shocking. He has to shake you to your very roots because he has to uproot your mind and transplant you in a totally different world. He has to change your level of being. It is not easy, it is arduous. It is painful too. It needs sacrifice. If you are ready to sacrifice, only be here. Otherwise, leave me because you will be wasting your time and mine too. If you are ready to go through all this suffering, that is a must. This sacrifice, this word sacrifice is beautiful. It means to make something holy, to make something sacred. If you are ready to take my shocks in deep trust and love, they will become sacred. Then my harshness will not look like harshness, it will look like compassion. You will feel that I said so because I loved so much. Otherwise, why should I bother? The fourth question, you, Buddha, Jesus, etc., are all men. You say women are closer to no mind. Why did you choose a man's body? Why are there no women masters? It is from Deva Chandan. Of course, a woman who belongs to the Lib movement. It is significant. The question has to be understood. It has never been in the past that a woman was ever a great master. And it will never be in the future either. The reason is that the feminine mind by its very nature is not aggressive. And to be a master, one has to be aggressive. It has nothing to do with the male chauvinists. It has nothing to do with the male-oriented society. Your question is almost like this: why the man is always the father and never the mother? Nothing can be done about it. It is natural. Only once it has happened, let me tell you the anecdote. A priest was in hospital for an exploratory operation to determine the cause of abdominal pains from which he had been suffering. In the hospital at the same time, a young unwed girl came and gave birth to a baby boy, which she explained to the doctors he did not want to keep. The quick-thinking physician approached the priest's bed as he awoke after the operation and explained to him that a miracle had occurred. God had given him a son. The priest at first shocked, took the baby boy in his arms and bowed his head in prayer, thanking God for the miracle. What else to do? Many years passed, the priest and boy living together as father and son. The time came for the boy to leave home to go to the college. The night before his departure, the priest approached the boy and chokingly said, "My son, I have a terrible confession to make to you." The puzzled boy looked up as the priest continued to speak. "I have always led you to believe that I am your father. Well, my son, it is not true. I am your mother. The bishop is your father." The male mind can be a master. To be a master means to be aggressive. A woman cannot be aggressive. A woman by its very nature is receptive. A woman is a womb. So the woman can become the best disciple possible. It is very difficult for a man to become a disciple. It is very simple for a woman to become a disciple. The master-disciple relationship is a man-woman relationship. You may not have looked at it that way, but try to look at it that way. The disciple is receptive. The disciple is a womb. That's why it is very difficult for males to become disciples. Some reluctance, some resistance, some fight, some ego continues. It is very difficult for man to become a disciple. The greatest disciples have always been women. Mary Magdalene is the greatest disciple Jesus had. But she could not become an apostle. She could not become a master. Yes, Buddha was also surrounded by beautiful, tremendously capable women. Mahavira was surrounded. Mahavira had 40,000 sannyasins, 30,000 women, 10,000 men. The proportion has been always so. Four disciples come, three are women, one is man. And that one man is not very reliable. He may have come for the women, he may not have come for the man. That danger always exists. But the greatest masters have always been men. Now this is a paradox. But this is how it is. Because a master has to go out in 1,001 ways to work on you. A master has to move out to help you. To hold your hands, to protect you, to shock you, to drag you into the unknown, to push you. 1,001 things he has to do, which are aggressive. That's why. It has nothing to do with the male-female conflict. It has nothing to do with the male-oriented society. Even in the future, when all equality has been established absolutely, man will be the father and woman will be the mother, and miracles don't happen. Fifth question. Everything is perfect, but also the third world war is coming. You say, do not try to change the world, but just outside the ashram gate, a beggar's child looks like he is nearly starving. What to do? Everything is perfect, but also the third world war is coming. That is going to be perfect too. It will kill utterly. It will be a total war. The perfect, the most perfect ever. Now, the problem arises, the world war is coming. And what you are doing here, meditating? You should go into the world and prevent the world war. Can you do that? Is it possible to prevent it? Is it possible to do anything about it? You will be wasting your life. You have a very short life. These few moments are very valuable. And they were never before so valuable, because the third world war is coming. Before there was always time. Now it seems any moment time will be finished. It can happen tomorrow morning. Anybody can go berserk. Richard Nixon, when he was in a turmoil, after the Watergate, he had ideas in his mind to create a third world war. He had the key to trigger the phenomena. And of course, he was in a great anxiety and anguish. And I must say this one thing in the favor of this man, that he resisted the temptation. It was very easy to trigger the war. And he would have become the last president of America. Really last. And he would have ended the whole history. He would have been the most historical person of all. Of course, there would have been nobody to write the history. That is another thing. And it would have been better, at least for him, not to be in such a disgrace. He could have saved his own ego. This must be said about the man, that he resisted the temptation, which was very easy. He could have simply started dropping atom bombs on Moscow. Within 15 minutes, just within 15 minutes, every single soul would have been dead on the earth. We have the capacity to kill the whole earth 7 times. We have the capacity to super kill. Each person on this earth can be killed 7 times, that much atom hydrogen bombs are ready, piled up, waiting. Any day, any politician can go berserk. And politicians are mad people. They are not very sane. Otherwise, why should they be in politics in the first place? You are sitting on a volcano. Never before it was so dangerous. And you think, what you are doing here, meditating, what else can you do? While the time is still there, meditate. If the volcano erupts and you die meditating, you will know the taste of the deathless. And if many people decide in the world to meditate, the Third World War may never happen. Because this has been observed again and again down the centuries. That if in a village of 100 people, only one person starts meditating, the whole quality of the consciousness of the village changes. 1% only. Because the 1% comes in contact with the 100% of the village, a small village. He is related to everybody. Somebody is an uncle and somebody is somebody else, somebody is a brother, somebody is related by the wife. He is related, interconnected. He starts vibrating a different energy, the meditative energy. The whole quality of the village consciousness changes by a single person's meditation. If only 1% humanity starts meditating, there is a possibility that the Third World War can be avoided. There is no other possibility. Why in the first place people are so violent that they have to fight again and again? In 3,000 years time, there have been 15,000 wars. 5 wars to each year. The whole humanity seems to be insane. We have been just fighting and doing nothing. Now, out of these 3,000 years violence, there is coming a crescendo. The final war, the total war. You would like to go into the world and convince the politicians or arrange a protest march towards Washington and Moscow. That is not going to help. Because, have you watched the people who join in the protest march are very violent people. Have you not watched it? They are shouting, there is slogan. They are all violent, aggressive people. Maybe they are for peace, but they are ready to fight for it. And the fight is the problem. What you will do? You will start shouting, you will create slogans, and you will get heated up by it, you will start fighting. That's what politicians have always been doing. Moscow is not for war, neither is Washington. The communist says, we have to arrange for war because we want peace in the world. And the same says the capitalist. The capitalist and the communist and the fascist, they are not different. They all prepare for war, and they all say they are preparing for peace. Now, you go on a protest march, and you are a violent person. The only protest march can be meditate, sit silently, and create a meditative energy. Once, in this ashram, there was a competition. A essay competition to describe the meditative person. And of course, as it can be expected, Mulla Nasruddin came first. His description is really beautiful. Mulla Nasruddin explained the difference between a person who is meditative and one who is not in this way. A non-meditative person is one. If he jumps off a skyscraper, goes whoosh, splat, finish. A meditative person is still clicking his fingers, halfway down saying, so far, so good. If it is going to happen, it is going to happen, you click your fingers and say, so far, so good. You are still alive. The third world war has not yet happened. Don't miss this chance to dance. And by your dancing, I am saying, you will create a ripple. Meditate. By your meditation, you will release a different quality of energy into the world. If you can convert 1% of the whole world into mad orange people dancing, singing, meditating, not at all political. Those protest marchers are political. Politics is the root cause. We need non-political persons. I have not voted ever in my life. And people will come to me and they will say, but you can vote for the person you would like. I say, to whomsoever I vote, it goes to a politician. I cannot vote. I am a non-participant. They are all the same. Their names differ. Now, this pacifist is also a political person. I would like you to create few people who are non-political. Non-political is what I mean by religious. A person who says, okay, if it is going to happen, it is going to happen. Why should I waste my time? I should meditate. I should enjoy. I should delight. Meanwhile, I am going to dance. If it is going to happen, it will happen. But why should I miss the dance? The time is short. If you start dancing, if you start loving, if you become friendly, if you enjoy life, you will create energy which will be for peace without thinking about peace at all. So I don't talk about peace. I talk about love. Peace follows love energy like a shadow. I know there is poverty. There are beggars. But what can you do? Whatsoever you do is not going to help. Down the centuries, people have been serving people, donating, giving money, clothes, food. Much philanthropy has been there. But nothing has happened. Then there have been communist countries where they saw that the religion has failed. In fact, religion has never been tried. But it looks as if religion has failed because by religious people, these people are thought. Those who donate, give charity and do things like that. These are not religious people. These are guilty people. They feel guilt. When a person accumulates too much money, he starts feeling guilty. No, he has to do something to unburden his guilt. So he gives into charities. This is just to console his own conscience. It happened. Andrew Carnegie has donated to many libraries, to many colleges, to many universities, colleges, medical colleges, and 1001 institutions. When he was dying, he was one of those robber barons. He inquired his secretary, "How much I have donated in my whole life?" He was dying. And he inquired, "How much I have donated in my whole life?" He had donated millions of dollars. The secretary rushed to the treasurer, inquired. It was a big list. He listened. The total was millions and millions of dollars. He was surprised. He opened his eyes. He suddenly became very much alive. And he said, "But from where? I wonder I could get that much money. From where? That much I have donated, but from where I could get that much money?" You have got it from the same people to whom you donate. From one pocket you take, from another hand you give them. And of course you never give the whole total amount. You just give a part of it. It is a trick. And this has not helped. If you need a world without poverty, greed has to disappear. Not charity is not going to help. It has not helped. Greed has to disappear. Hoarding has to disappear. That's what I am trying to teach you. If you love life, you never become a hoarder. Life is so beautiful. Who bothers about tomorrow? That's why I go on repeating again and again, live in the moment. Then there will be no beggars. But you live in the future, then there are going to be beggars. You accumulate for the future, then certainly it cannot be available to all who are alive right now. The earth is enough for the people who are alive. If nobody gathers for the future, hoards for the future, thinks of the future, everybody will be happy and everybody will have enough. But you think about the future. You are not happy right now. You think tomorrow I will be happy. So you sacrifice your present and you sacrifice somebody else's present too, to hold for the future. The beggar on the street is not the problem. The beggar on the street is simply a symptom. Your greed is the problem. You can give something to the beggar. I'm not saying don't give. It will give you a consolation that you have done something. You give to the beggar. And the beggar is in the same boat. He is also hoarding. He may not be so beggarly as he looks, because I know about beggars who have bank balances. It may be just his profession, so he has to be beggarly. He has to show that he is dying, because you have become so hard. Unless somebody is dying, you will not melt. He has to sit there, shivering in the cold. He can afford a blanket. He has enough money, but he cannot afford it, because if he has the blanket, you will not feel sorry. You will not feel guilty. His shivering gives you a shivering. He has to pretend. I used to know one student. He was in the university, my student. I inquired him that where you live. He said, "Don't ask, sir." I insisted, so he said, "I have never told to anyone because my father has told me not to say to anybody. But I can say to you, please don't say it to anybody." I said, "What is the matter?" He said, "My father is a beggar. And you must have seen him. He begs on the railway station." I said, "He is your father?" "He is my father. And he has enough money. But I cannot say it to anybody. Otherwise, his prestige as a beggar will be at a stake." And this boy used to live always like a rich man. And that beggar I knew because I was continuously traveling. So every day I was coming and going from the station. And I was one of the persons whom he was cheating. And always he will take something from me. Coming or going, I had to give something to him. He will not leave me. I said, "Okay, next time I will see." So next time I went, and he came running, that I am dying, and my wife is very ill and in the hospital. I said, "And what about your son?" He said, "What son?" I said, "He is my student." He said, "Sir, please don't say to anybody. And I will never bug you anymore. If you want to help, you help. But remember, that is not my cup of tea. It is your trip. And please don't try to lay your trips on me. If you want to help, beggars help. You help to the very extent when you become a beggar. Go on. Then others will help you. This is how things have been going on. Because charity has not helped, communism came in. And communism has not helped either. It has not made anybody rich. It has simply made the rich poor. The poor remains the poor. Only the rich has disappeared. But now there is no comparison. That's why Russians don't allow their citizens to go and see America. That is dangerous. Because the American poor is far more richer than the Russian rich. It is dangerous. In Russia, the rich man has disappeared. All are poor. Equality has been established because all are poor. Nobody is rich, true. But the poverty has not changed. And the greed has not changed. Now the estate has become greedy. Now the estate plans for the future. 70% of their budget goes to war preparation. The country remains hungry. People don't have shoes, people don't have clothes, but 70% of the budget goes to war preparations for the future, for some third world war. This is communism. Communism has failed more than the old ways of charity, because it has created a new class. The rich man is not there, but the bureaucrats. The bourgeoisie has disappeared, but the bureaucracy has come in. Now the rich man is not there, but the Communist Party members. Now he is the elite. And the same operation continues in a far more stronger way. Never before on the earth there was such a slavery as exists in Russia and China. So what to do, you ask? My suggestion is, don't think that you can prevent the third war. Don't think that you can change the poverty. You can change only yourself. Drop your greed. Drop your future. Drop your mind. Become more loving. Become more heartful. And live from that heart. And if many people start living that way, that is the only way to change the world. The world cannot be changed directly because there is no soul to the world. The soul exists in the individual. Only individuals can be changed. If you remain a hoarder, greedy, violent, repressed, this society will continue. And you can give money to the beggar and he will remain a beggar because money never changes anything. I have seen millionaires and still beggars. So miserly that whatsoever they have makes no difference. I have heard two Jewish refugees passed the home of John D. Rockefeller. If I only had that man's millions, sighed one of them, I would be richer than he is. That does not make sense, the other reminded him. If you had Mr. Rockefeller's millions, you would be just as rich as he, not richer. You are wrong, said the first, assured him. You are wrong, the first assured him. Don't forget that I could give Hebrew lessons on the side. Now a beggar remains beggar. He will give Hebrew lessons on the side. Even if he has all the money of John D. Rockefeller. People don't change. Money never changes anything. If you change, that is it. Altogether different thing. I am not saying don't have compassion. I am saying have compassion. But don't think that by your compassion the world is going to change. Don't hope that. Give whatsoever you can give. Share whatsoever you can share. But share only out of love. Don't think in terms of politics of changing the world. Otherwise you will be frustrated. Forget all about it. You do whatsoever you feel like doing. If you meet a beggar and you have a feeling arising in you, do something. Whatsoever you feel like doing. I'm not saying don't do anything. I'm saying simply don't hope that you are changing the world. Nothing is being changed. The only way to change the world is to change the level of consciousness. And that you can do only in yourself. It cannot be done to anybody else from the outside. Yes, if you change your level of consciousness, you create vibes which change people. Which change people without their knowledge. A different milieu is needed in the world. Not a different society, but a different milieu. A different spiritual vibe is needed. That's why I am not interested directly. I don't want to make you social servants, missionaries, and things like that. I want you to be absolutely selfish. First, try to know who you are. This is first principle of selfishness. First, try to love. This is second principle of selfishness. Love yourself so that you can love others. And the third principle of selfishness, live the moment delightfully, celebrating. And then something will start happening through you. You will become a triggering point. A world process starts. Whenever a Buddha happens, a world process starts. You become a Buddha, awakened. That's all that you can do. The last question. It is from Swami Yogchinmaya. As Kabir is singing the path of love, excuse me asking a personal question. I could not resist the temptation so. When did you have your last girlfriend and the last love relationship? And he has disappeared. I cannot see him here. Whenever he asks a question, he hides. Just the other day he was sitting in the first row. Now he has disappeared.
You are all my girlfriends. Boys included. But this will not satisfy him. He needs something esoteric. So for him especially, please, anybody else should not listen to it. You close your ears. It is only especially for Swami Yogchinmaya. Because the esoteric thing has to be very secret. I had a girlfriend when I was young. When she died. But on her deathbed, she promised me she will come. And I was afraid. And she has come back. The name of the girlfriend was Sasi. She died in 47. She was the daughter of a certain doctor, Dr. Sarma, of my village. He is also dead now. And now she has come as Vivek to take care of me. Vivek cannot remember it. I used to call Sasi Gudiya, and I have started calling Vivek also Gudiya, just to give a continuity. Life is a great drama, a great play. It goes on from one life to another to another. This is especially for Chinmay. I hope nobody else has heard it. And the really, really last one. I have heard, Bhagwan, that when you walk, your feet don't touch the ground. Have you something to say about it? That's true. When I walk, my feet don't touch the ground. But there is nothing miraculous about it. They don't touch the ground because I always wear the shoes. If it does not satisfy you, because you would like your master to be a great miracle maker, then just to satisfy you, I would like to say that those shoes are of awareness. And if you also wear the shoes of awareness, your feet will not touch the ground. It is simple. It is not miraculous. And you have asked, have you something to say about it? That is dangerous. The time is over. I have nothing to say about it. But if I have to say, it takes 90 minutes. And the time is over. And my bladder is full. And I would like to go to the bathroom. Excuse me. Enough for today.